Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
It's a great day today. It's very beautiful and sunny outside.
Buenos dias.
Josh is in the Southern Hemisphere right now.
There he is. All right. We have a game of what are we drinking?
Oh, right. So we have something sent in. The Williams, Thor and Ellie Williams gave us this roast back at Refresh Conference. I've had it here for a while. We've just...
Man, that's nice.
...not had a opportunity. We've had a lot of coffee given to us. Thank you.
I'd like to try my hand this week.
All right. Have you practicing. Drank some of it?
I think so. Okay. I don't know. Okay. I took it from this.
This is going to be amazing.
Okay. Oh, so, wait. This one?
Sure.
That's mine. That's the backup. One. That's the wrong one.
But never mind.
You can...
Way to shatter his hopes and dreams.
Sorry, I shouldn't
Andy.
Have said anything. Well, the flavors.
I had a joke about less. I can't even say it. Lethoso. Did you guys see the Trump comment about, you know, USAID and the strange funds that they're sending out? And he's like, Lethoso. Who even knows where that is?
Right? And that's what you were going to say.
I was going to say, yeah, but I botched it because I can't even pronounce it. But I do know where it is, and I knew that's where it was so when Trump was saying that.
So. Do they produce coffee?
I don't know.
If that is the correct answer, $1 million to Josh.
So I think this is good. I don't know what it is at all. Or what,
shout out. Can we go back?
Oh, yeah.
Shout out to Fuller, Reverend Fuller,
huh?
For texting us about your septum. That was fun.
Oh, yeah. That was really nice. Thank you, yeah. Jonathan. We really appreciate you talking about my septum. Thanks. And Josh still has not apologized, just so you know.
So I don't Moving know what on. You think, but this feels like kind of a, I get some sense of like a caramel. It's really smooth like that.
It's also, there's like a smoky.
It's probably not flavored though.
Like you don't smoke coffee beans. Like you don't smoke them like, there's like a smokiness to me or roastiness. It's not bad at all, but I can't tell anything. It's not a dark. It's not a light. I don't know what it is. Tim, give us some info.
I'm going to go Mexico.
Oh, can we pick regions?
Yeah.
Oh, this is...
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to try some here.
I'm going to say...
on the bag, it said the region.
Indonesia.
Okay.
Ooh,
that was a nice guess.
That feels mm-hmm. better than Mexico.
It's wrong. But
it has a...
It was a nice guess. Okay, let's keep going. Do you have something, Charlie? Josh?
He said Mexico.
It feels like a light roast.
Oh, yeah, he said Mexico.
Just throw a dart on a board.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like a medium light. I'm going to go medium light with a smokiness.
It does have
a smokiness, which I would expect from somebody named Thor.
Ooh.
That was nice.
Scandinavian horrendous. Region.
That's good. Oh, that's really good. What do we got?
It is a blend, but okay. It's all South American.
Oh, bummer.
Peru, Colombia, and Brazil. No Mexico.
Peru, Colombia, and Brazil.
Though. You are close.
My dart was closer.
It was
And what's
closer.
The roast level?
This is the, it's a light roast. Okay. Persnickety, Crane, Coffee, House, and Cafe.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a nice light roast from Virginia, I think.
It's good.
They're in Virginia, I think.
It's got a lot of depth of flavor, so that's
like
really
it.
Good.
Ooh. I like it.
I'm not really a respecter of coffee, but that is good.
That's true. You have a very specific coffee need, though. You like that one roast, that one kind that doesn't give you a heartburn, right?
Sure. I thought you were going to say I need it into my veins. That's, I mean, to stay alive,
Are
to stay
awake.
Are we
playing again?
Oh, no, we
we're
don't
just,
have to,
we're
but
just
we can.
Drinking.
Would you like to say where the other coffee's from?
Well, the other coffee we're drinking is from a local coffee shop called Light Bright in Grimes.
Woo.
A fancy, nice town. Very quaint, very homey. Yeah. Almost like someone would want to move there, Charlie.
Yeah, it's a great place to live.
So,
all right, let's go to some listener interaction. Number one, Tim, David Sturtz, and Brian Collins emailed in talking about 1 Samuel commentaries.
Yeah, they similarly really liked Steinman. And so thanks for writing that in. Brian also mentioned Firth in the Apollos Old Testament commentary series, which I actually have that one as well. And I've been getting into it recently, and it is a decent commentary. So thanks for throwing that into the mix. I didn't like Firth in Joshua, or maybe I should say I just didn't find him very trustworthy. He metaphorizes Joshua's long day. like Joshua has that long day and it's basically the cosmic battles fighting. And I'm like, that's a miss. That was David Firth. So I kind of, I don't know, I've kind of a little cautious on him. But still, I've met him at ETS and sat in some of his sessions. He's a very good scholar. He also mentioned a couple of others, the reign and rejection of King Saul, which he liked in the Saul narratives. So thanks for sending that in. I am not familiar with that one at all. I'll have to take a look sometime. Then David Sturz similarly liked the Steinman and Tsumura. He threw in also Bill Arnold's NIV application commentary, which is not as exegetical, but helpful for preaching, he mentioned. So David, thanks for writing in. And I appreciate getting your guys' feedback. So keep writing in and talking to us.
I'll read one line without comment submitted by Brian Collins. I've been enjoying the podcast, especially the addition of Dr. Boyd. Woo. Presented without comment.
Thank you. Check is in the mail.
That's great.
All right. Other listener interaction. Melissa Troutman emailed in and asked about my one sheet to rule them all.
I'm so excited about this.
So I'm going to describe it a little bit more. It is a Google sheet that is titled The One Sheet to Rule Them All. And Andy's blowing his nose. It has captivated all of us.
The one sheet. Come on, keep it one going. Sheet.
So what I did was I went through, I tried to come up with categories of what I think is the most valuable things that I do. Like what's most important, like ranking them. Give or take, there's about 20 categories. And then from those 20 categories, I then decided how much time should be allotted to them. And I did this specifically. So there's 24 hours in a day, multiply that by 7. If I have number one category, this is where I should be spending most of my time. How many hours do you devote to that a week? And then the one sheet organizes all of those. So you have like the grid on the first page, which is all the categories, how much time. And then there's some categories that are not weekly, but they're like monthly. You should be spending this amount of time monthly. And then from there, I have a whiteboard in my apartment that has segments, 24 for each day. And you guys, I have colored magnets.
This is so fantastic.
I know. I knew you were going to go crazy about this because you're like this whole organizational productivity guru too.
Let me finish what I'm talking about.
Whatever.
Hey, shh. Mute your microphone. I'll disconnect you. So on my marker board, I have 7 columns that each have 24 rows, and I have colored magnets that represent, you know, for each box. And so I go through and I, in a bullet journal, I map out how each hour of each week should be spent. Now, do I ever hit that? Absolutely not. But the goal is that on a Sunday night, you'd reset the marker board and you'd be able to allot the correct amount of time to the most important things. And then you have a color-coded way of tracking it that you see every day when you wake up. And then you have a really portable bullet journal that has all of that same information. You can take it with you everywhere. It's my precious. So you, you always know what's most important. And what I really liked is it makes decisions for you. Let's say that number 17 on the list is like, hey, I need an hour this week. And you're like, well, number 17, you're not more important than 1 through 16. So no, I'm not going to do that this week. Maybe I could schedule it next week or next month. And so that's what's really been helpful for me, is it simplifies when something tries to gain your time, how it gets it. And you don't let lower numbers trump bigger numbers.
See, I think that's really, really great. I think it is a tracker, but what the value of it is that it makes decisions for you. Like objectively, I think it's really great.
Because I like to say yes to everybody and yep. everything. And this has really helped. Like, is there a difference between someone saying, hey, would you meet with me on Thursday? And they're not connected with your church. They're just some random person that you kind of know, or it's a young man from your church. And there's different categories for that. And one of them gets a yes and one of them gets a no, because one of them is way more important than the other. And that's not to slight the person that doesn't go to my church. There are very few hours for that, but there are a lot of hours for discipleship with young guys from my church. And so that's a practical way that's helped.
And if you were someone who didn't have a problem saying no to people, that list would sound totally tedious like the man across from me at the table.
That's exactly what it is.
So I have a story about this. I made a Excel spreadsheet and just put some projects in, and then you can do conditional formatting to make them automatically change colors. I've done that in the past. You talked about your one sheet to rule them all, and I thought, oh man, I'm going to do this again. That would be a good thing for me right now with some projects I have. So I made it, and then I had a student who came in not doing well, and we were talking about they're trying to improve their grade, and I realized the reason they're not doing well is they're using Canvas's to-do list function, which is just like 1 week of an assignments. And I'm like, well, how do you know about all your stuff? And so as a student, I would always write everything in a spreadsheet and then organize it by date. So I had this student do this, and I said, let me show you I call this the one sheet to rule them all. But actually, it's because my friend Charlie has 2 one sheets to rule them all. And I'm just riffing off that. And so I told the student they had to make it. They had to put an entire class's worth of homework in, and they had to come up with a silly name for it. And so this student did this, and then is now all of them in there, and it's working great. But her name for her sheet was, it's a list, right? So it's the Infinity Gaunt list. And I was like, that's the greatest little, like, because it's like the fan. I was like, oh, that was so good. So that's all I wanted to add.
It's a cultural reference.
And she was unimpressed that I was just riffing off Charlie. So now I am tasked with making a cultural reference for my list. So if you guys, Tim, if you have a submission for a name, you know, you feel free to let me know.
I just despise the to-do list of Canvas. I wish they'd get rid of it.
I agree.
The students don't understand.
The lie in the list and the wardrobe.
That's good. Oh, the lie in the list and the wardrobe. I was thinking like a pragmatometrist or something like that from that. Or the list that is never late, nor is it early, as a reference to Gandalf's little thing.
Okay, we can move on to Garth Hellman sent us a video where he pontificated on who his favorite Thinkling was.
This is important.
And to surprise and shock of all of us.
Including me.
He chose Tim. So, Gar, thank you for your email. But we kindly want to let you know that we will no longer regard your sentiments on this podcast. Clearly, you are a beast of vile passions to choose Tim as your favorite.
I love you, Garth. Thank you.
And this is all a joke.
One more cultural reference. You cut me deep, Garth.
Oh, that's so good.
All right. Let's Party move time. On to some Excellent. Bookstore and publications notes. Josh has a book to mention here that is available in Faith Bookstore.
The Sin of Empathy by Joe Rigney. It's a recent release. It is available at the Faith Bookstore. 25% off.
Yeah, it's on sale. Pick it up. It's a really good book and kind of spicy.
All right. Here's what's in the rest of this episode. We're going to do books and business like normal. For the main content, we have Godliness Part 3 from Andy. And since we'll be in the Bible for the content, we won't have a final meditation. So I think we're ready.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
Okay, so this week I read, I'll give a review another time just because I'll go quickly today since I have the content, but a little tiny book called How Do We Live in a Digital World by Ben Mitchell. It's in a series put out. It's like Lexham Press and Trinity, and it's like, how do we question? So how should Christians think about truth and sex by Christopher Ashe is in this series. Who is Jesus of Nazareth by Craig Bomberg. What is the Bible, Graham Cole? What is the Christian worldview, Graham Cole? How do we know God exists, William Lane Craig? There's a whole bunch of books in this series called Questions for Restless Minds. So my pastor had a whole bunch of books for sale 2 weeks ago, and I just have to say that's a mark of a great pastor when he puts out a bunch of good books for cheap because he's trying to get the congregation to read. I was super excited. I walked home with $22 worth of books. No book was more than $5. You're going to say something.
No, I don't have anything to say.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
It was
Enjoy
really good.
Your books.
Thank you. L'chaim to you. So this book is just 5 short chapters on how to think through technology, and I'll just give you 2 quotes and the technological age, and then I'll review it more thoroughly later. He was talking about the value and the promise of technology in our world. So what does technology promise? And most of the time, people would argue that the reason they use technology is because it betters their life. And he made a quote that I thought was interesting. He said this. He said, We must assume that technology makes life better, or we most likely would reject it. And since, quote, better, quote, implies some notion of the good life, the invention and adoption of a particular technology is informed by certain values. And I thought that was a very helpful thing. When you pick a technological tool or object or app to use, you have made a moral judgment that you think that's valuable. So when you're using stuff, you're at least making value statements. And that kind of frames the whole discussion well. So I thought that part of the book was helpful. And then the only other thing I was going to mention is this experiment. He had heard about this guy who decided not to use technology at all for a day and see what he could do. And he showed how there's so much friction in our lives today without technology. So a lot of us would say, oh, if we could just get rid of technology. And so his second chapter is actually the benefits of technology to where it's actually really helpful. So he said this. Another guy did this. So Michael Patrick Lynch said that a lot of what we do today is Google knowing. It's not actually knowing. It's Google knowing. This book is full of great terms. And it's anyone who can just look stuff up. So Lynch wanted to do an experiment. And so he said this. He wrote down four rather random questions that he wanted to try to answer. One, what is the capital of Bulgaria? Two, is a four-stroke outboard motor more efficient than a two-stroke? Three, What is the phone number to my U.S. representative? And four, what is the best reviewed restaurant in Austin, Texas this week? And so he goes and tries to answer all of those without using a computer. And it's a great story. He's like, well, I had to go find a phone book and I didn't have a phone book. And then when I did go and finally find one at the library, they didn't have one either. They just had computers. So I had to go and find a historic phone book that was like 10 years old. And then when he had to look this other thing up and he realized that we want to jettison technology, but the world has changed so much, we functionally can't do that. And then so the author's like, so I tried to answer those and it took me 2 minutes on Google. So really interesting book, interesting conclusions. I would recommend it. No ranking yet.
All right. And so I finished Brothers K.
Woo!
All 897 pages of it.
I feel like you deserve a round of applause, man. That was impressive.
That was a beast.
I have
seriously. That was
I have
impressive.
Thoughts that we were talking about off air, but it's just such a hard book to summarize. I'm not going to rate it. I'll just comment. I think it's worth reading, and I'm going to put it next to something else. So while reading Brothers K, physically reading it, I was also listening audiobook through Harry Potter. And I've noticed a trend. I would much more willingly choose to listen. And I started asking myself, why would I do that? It's just, you know, right on cue with the technology. It is so much easier. It's practice. You just grab your phone, you play it, you can be listening while you're doing other things. You can do it in your car. And so there's a lot of nice things about that. But there's no doubt it was getting chosen more frequently because it's like, I don't really want to go through the work of thinking about this really dense book. And that's to me was, I think, a substantive life lesson where it's like, while I read this massive Russian classic, I also listened to Harry Potter. And both of them were entertaining. Both of them were worth my time. But one of them took so much more effort to attain. And I think that it's character building. Honestly, I think that there's something to, like, you know what? And I have Brothers K as an audiobook. And I shared earlier on the podcast that I was trying to read a chapter physically and then go back and listen to it. And I eventually just gave that up because I noticed, like, I just like, man, this is so much easier to listen to it. But you catch a completely different aspect of the work when you read it versus when you listen to it. And so I think it's a practical lesson in how the medium really does change what you're gaining. That an audiobook is a different medium. It's a different format of information. And so it is much easier entertainment, much easier to grasp. Not saying that it's evil for that in any way, but I think that's probably one of the biggest things I'll take away from the experience is that just the value of, you can make time to read for 45 minutes a night. That is not too cumbersome for you. Even a book that you don't really get, like, you can make time for that. And just building that practice into your life is enriching to you. And that's completely separate from what the book is. And I said this lamentingly off air. I think before I can make any statements about it, I have to read it again. And so I think it is good. It's a classic for a reason. I think it's worth your time. It's probably going to take you 2 to 3 months. But now that I know what's there, I think I'll go through it much quicker. But then there's sections that are in there that grab your attention, and you try to focus on them. And it's a good book.
Sweet.
Josh, you have a comment there?
I just was going to say, when people talk about that novel with me, I typically tell them, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you, Charlie, or not, but I typically tell them, don't read it alone. Find a group of people that are also interested in reading it, because that will really help, because then you can talk about it. Yeah. And so we tend to be reading, and we tend to be in our silos of reading, but really reading is something that you have to be doing with other people in some sense.
I do think that would have been, if there was a weekly or bi-weekly, like, hey, let's talk about this, that would have definitely helped. Because something, especially with the four of us, when we read things collectively, we each grab different things.
We should do that again.
We should.
We have not read a book together.
It's not been since Four Loves.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I've got a book.
No, we're not reading Brothers Karamazov or whatever it is.
Don't write it off just yet.
No, okay? We're not.
Let's just think about it. Sorry. Let it marinate.
It's marinated.
It was more like dipped and pulled right out, Tim. You did not marinate that one bit.
Horrendous. So let's see here. This drops, when this drops, I'll be heading out with Dr. Paul to Cedarville University, for the regional ETS conference, March, I think it's like 21st, 22nd, something like that, Friday, Saturday. And I'll be presenting my paper, Decrystallizing the Song of Songs, Applying the Song Through the Lens of Divine Absence. Dr. Paul will be presenting something on religious liberty. If you are in the area and want to come to one of those sessions, I'm sure you could reach out to us and we can help you figure that out. But with that, what I've been doing is studying the Song of Songs, specifically Song of Songs chapter 8 and verse 6. Well, there's been a few places, but this has been the most recent one, and this connects to my books and business. So in Song 8, 6, the very end of the verse reads from the ESV, "Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord." So that last word, the very flame of the Lord, is the one questionable appearance of the Lord in the Song of Songs. The New King James Version translates it a most vehement flame. So you could see why this would be an important phrase for me, since I'm saying Jesus isn't in the Song of Songs. Applying the song through the lens of divine absence, well, is the Lord in Song 8:6 or is he not? And I concluded that he is not. I believe that it's an homage to him. And to translate it, the flame of the Lord is too overt. And I just got a brand new book on the Song of Songs, which costs a whole lot more than $3.
I'd say that's Hermania, man. That's probably spendy.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know, anyway. It cost me $70 and that was on sale. So Song of Songs by Adele Berlin. Adele Berlin has written several Old Testament commentaries and resources. She's one of the scholars that I follow. She's a feminist. So when I saw this was released in 2025, so it's literally just come out, I just picked it up because I knew that I was going to be interacting with it. And I will say, not many people were with me on the, this is an homage to the Lord. So the word that's used there, it says Yah at the end, which is the shortened version of the Lord's personal name, Yahweh. It's just Yah. And it's connected to the word. And so the question is it flame of the Lord, or is it just like a really hot flame? And the answer is neither. I think that it is an homage to the Lord, the creator of love, but it is not an explicit reference to him. And so I found a couple other commentators that would do something similar. Are you following? So like Cheryl Exum, she translates it an almighty flame. You see what she's trying to do?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
It's like an echo, or like an echo.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice.
And then Tremper Longman, he translated it in almighty, or no, he did a godlike flame, which is too explicit to me. It just kind of doesn't have a good ring to it. It's kind of dumb. And then he did a god awful flame, which sounds a little sacrilegious to me. I didn't like that one either. So she chose a supreme flame and then capitalized the S in supreme.
Oh, that's nice.
So she's trying to do a similar type of a theme thing. And I think she hits a home run. Let's see here. So I'm going to just read a little. I, too, prefer to have it both ways. Both ways being it's a flame, but then it's a reference to the Lord. I, too, prefer to have it both ways. Not because I cannot decide between the alternatives, but because I think this double entendre is intended. Okay. The word means flame. Like a really hot flame. That's what it means. But it's a double entendre, which is an homage to the Lord, which is where I came down on the discussion too. While the form functions as a superlative, the trace of God's name still adheres to it. And so then she goes into some other stuff. But anyway, I was really impressed because not many people take that view. And that's where I landed after a lot of study, by the way. None of the ancient translations translate it God's name. And that was a big thing for me as I was working through this discussion. They allegorize the song all the time. So if you have a reference to the Lord, why would they not reference the Lord? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a really good argument there, like historically.
You would think that if they're going to put God anywhere, they'd put it in a place that it would make the most sense. He's not there. They always just translate it flame, flames, or it's flame. And so that was another factor in it. There are two textual traditions in the Hebrew, but the one that is preserved, and that is quite likely the accurate one, is flame, not flame of the Lord. There is one that does separate out the Yah, so then it's flame of the Lord, and they make a big deal about, oh, there is a textual tradition, and I'm like, yeah, that's like really minor. I studied through that, and then you have all of this other evidence, okay? And I'm like, yeah, no, it's not there. So, Song of Songs by Adele Berlin, just released, and I really liked that part. A couple other parts I didn't like, but new commentary.
Well, the book that I have this week is the aforementioned new release by Joe Rigney, The Sin of Empathy, Compassion, and Its Counterfeits. Empathy is having, or is a subject of conversation pretty regularly, particularly over the last 5 or 6 years within Christian circles. Ali Beth Stuckey had a book that came out last year called Toxic Empathy. I have not read that yet, but I definitely want to. And I purchased this one at the Faith Bookstore, as I mentioned, and I have just a couple of passages to read.
Whoop. Faith Bookstore. Boom. There you go. I don't know. Great. I feel like I got to say something.
You do.
Pointed at me. So it's I did my duty.
Well, it's like when there's a friend of the podcast, Charlie says something. When it's a bookstore, we expect you to say something.
That's right. Yeah. So Rigney begins in his introduction by mentioning that sympathy or compassion or pity is something that the Bible both tells us to have, and also it tells us at times to refrain from showing pity or compassion to certain people. And he mentions early on that that's difficult for people in modern churches to grasp, this idea that pity would ever be prohibited. And so I'll read one passage about that, and then I'll read a second passage. We are to be characterized by tender-hearted compassion and pity, like God, and yet there are times when pity and compassion are strictly and absolutely forbidden. It's this second principle that is difficult for many moderns to accept, the idea that pity and compassion could ever be sinful, could ever be inappropriate and wrong, is almost blasphemous in the modern world. And as a result, the modern world has sought to give compassion an upgrade, to improve it and make it more loving. Enter empathy. This book is about that shift, the shift from compassion to empathy, and how it wreaks havoc on families, churches, relationships, and societies. So obviously the word sympathy means feeling with, empathy means feeling in, and part of what he's doing in this book, at least in the early stages, is he's describing something he calls untethered empathy. This idea that sympathy is something that keeps you tethered to the truth. You feel with somebody, but there's a part of you that's also still tethered to the truth, and so you can speak truth to somebody. But untethered empathy is when you jump right in with the person, and at times that connection to truth is lost. And that's what he's really focusing in on. So let me read a few more passages here. Because empathy is an emotive connection closely tied to the immediate feelings of the hurting, it is fundamentally reactive. It leaps to alleviate what seems to be the most visible cause of suffering, and thus sometimes mistakes a symptom for the root. Sympathy, on the other hand, is fundamentally responsive. It maintains enough emotional space to consider the picture as a whole and not get lost in the immediate acuteness of the suffering. As a result, it is able to make, it is able to take sober-minded and carefully considered action to address others' pain. In this sense, the separation involved in sympathy and compassion is rooted not in apathy, but in a deep desire for the good of the afflicted. What's more, sympathy is humble since it recognizes that the hot emotion of the present moment may not be the whole story. In fact, the hot emotion may blur our vision of what is most needful. Since empathy entails a suspension of judgment and a more comprehensive sharing of emotion, then the danger of empathy is drowning in the pain and suffering of another. If a sufferer is sinking in quicksand, an empathetic helper jumps in after them with both feet. A sympathetic helper, on the other hand, steps into the quicksand with one foot while keeping the other firmly planted on the shore. There's the emotional boundary. Sympathy lays hold of something sturdy outside of the pit in order to provide an anchor so that we can better help the one in the quicksand. And this is the critique of sympathy by those that are promoting empathy, and that is that there's a kind of coldness to sympathy because you keep one foot rooted in truth or on something firm. But he's arguing that that's actually necessary and essential to properly help people.
I'll just add to that. I don't know about you guys, but I've felt that, felt that when you're meeting with someone and you're walking through a struggle, that there can almost be, you don't want to be cold and clinical, but you also can't just, like, as the book describes, jump in with them and get lost in the emotion of it. So I really like that idea of kind of, you've got a foot into the truth and the reality. You do want to be compassionate with them, but you have to understand the danger. But there's times that I've left a meeting thinking, was I too cold? Was I warm enough?
Yep.
And so that's a very practical consideration to make in the realm of discipleship.
It'd be a really good content sometime to talk about that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's have another conversation about godliness. This will probably be the last godliness post or episode I do for a while. This will complete my personal study on the topic of godliness. Today, we're going to go through the last three verses that use the term godliness in the New Testament that I studied. There's a whole bunch, but I remember I picked like a handful that I thought were significant. And so what I've tried to do is tie these last three together. I think last time we used the theme of discernment because you're avoiding one thing and you're pursuing another thing. And the first time it was sort of an introduction to it and the idea that knowledge actually leads us somewhere. Today, I'm going to call this the three P's of godliness, the three P's of godliness, and those P's are prayer, perspective, and a person. Prayer, perspective, and a person. These are not all linked. It's just my way to package them together. So I don't know if you guys are open to reading some Bible verses for me. Do you have the notes up in front of you, Charlie?
I do.
Okay, do you want to go ahead and read? So the first P of godliness is praying for rulers leads to greater opportunity for godliness. Praying for rulers leads to greater opportunity for godliness. That's 1 Timothy 2:1-2. Oh, it's fitting that you read this one because this is your like Hobbit verse. Go for it.
First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way.
Thank you. What I liked about this verse is that it's not actually telling me something that I think automatically leads to godliness. What I think it is it's something that sort of clears the way to godliness or aids you in your pursuit of being godly. And so this one describes the lifestyle that we're able to live well when the rulers who we pray for allow us to live a quiet and tranquil life. So I was using this one resource, the Exegetical Summary, and it just had this comment that I thought was helpful. The tranquil life is prayed for so that it will be the setting for reaching the ultimate goal expressed in this clause. Pray for authority so that we may live a tranquil and quiet life that will allow us to conduct ourselves with godliness and dignity. I like the way it kind of reworded that passage there. And so you just start to think about this. And when you think about praying for your rulers, sometimes that can be challenging because they're super ungodly. And so when this verse says pray for them so that it'll like allow you to live in a godly way, what if you have a leader who's not godly, who comes to power, but then makes decisions that actually makes it better for us to live godly lives? Does this verse excuse that leader's ungodliness? Well, I would say no. So, and obviously, there's a whole pile of Christians today who do not like our current president, President Trump, because he has an ungodly testimony. And I would say I recognize that. I would never stand up to the defense of Trump's character. I think in the past he's done a lot of wicked things. I think in the present there are different kinds of wicked things he does, and not quite the same as before. But I still wouldn't be willing to stick my neck out for him. However, when I look back at his first term, there were many good things that helped me to be able to like live a quiet and peaceful life. And I was thankful for that. During the Biden administration, all the woke nonsense that was going around, you got to think about when those kinds of things are being promoted in the land, that takes a different kind of effort in our walk with the Lord. And now Trump's like repealing all the DEI and all that stuff to the point where like our state house, didn't the Iowa State House deny, like they took out gendered language. It's just male and female. Like, so those things are good things. Those are beneficial things. So I liked what this brought me to think about, that my context matters for my godliness. But that made me think of this question. So in this passage, when he says pray for your leaders so you can live a quiet life, essentially we're learning from Paul that godliness is not only dependent on what's inside of me and my soul. There is something, I'm not going to say I'm dependent on or source from or I can blame, but there's something about my context that affects my godliness. Here, it's the political leaders, but that also means that other things outside me could affect it. So what about our lives right now, but don't think politically? What about your life could change in a way that would help you to have a better opportunity to be godly? But think about it like this. What's outside of you? Now, I'm not trying to play the blame game. Okay, so I'll just start off. So growing up, and this one's the extreme example, I went over to a buddy's house and no parents were around. It was a couple friends, and a parent had been there, but they went to go buy some movie tickets. We were going to go see The Mask. That's how long ago this was, with Jim Carrey. And as soon as they left the house, my buddy and his friends whipped out some magazines that you shouldn't have out in front of your parents because they are inappropriate with people not wearing clothes. Now, immediately, my friend saw that I was like often, I didn't know what this was, but I knew it wasn't good. And so they put him away. But that was pornography. And that exposure happened because you can buy porn in our country. Now, today, is porn more or less available?
Yeah, it's
way, way, right. Way more. You can live in a culture where you're exposed to these things without choosing to be exposed. And now you have to fight this whole fight. I'm not essentially arguing for isolation. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that what's in your environment can affect you. So can you guys think of any other things in our environment that might either make it harder to be godly, or if it changed, it might make it easier to be godly? Any ideas? I know I'm hitting you cold with this.
Yeah, it is interesting, your quote here. Pray for authority so that we may live tranquil and quiet lives that will allow us to conduct ourselves with all godliness and dignity. You know, when you have some authorities, or if you have a situation in life where which is encouraging that godliness, then it's easier to do. And I like how you're trying to be careful not to create excuses so that if you are around it or whatever, that doesn't give you an excuse. Well, I did it because of this situation or circumstance. No,
exactly.
We never have an excuse. But, you know, it says in Proverbs 5, don't go near the door of the bad girl's house. All right. So what's around you is important, and you need to, and if you have the opportunity, then separate yourself from ungodly influences. So I am not thinking of anything specifically, just the environment in which we live is going, we don't live in a vacuum. So there is going to be some, we're breathing the cultural air. So it's going to affect us in being aware of that. And then if we can improve it, then pray that we can, and then act in a way that we can improve it.
Yeah, I think my first thought isn't towards the negative side of it, like what are things that make it harder, but I thought, what are things that are around me that make it easier? And I thought of the relationships you have in the church, and thinking about, if you don't have the spiritual group of the church looking to each other to stir up love and good works, if you truly were isolated in a spiritual sense, how much harder that would be to live a godly life. Yep. If not for the base reason of you couldn't fulfill any of the one another commands. So like, to be godly is to love your neighbor. Well, if you're not around other people, how do you do that? And so that's kind of where I thought. But we do live in a very individualistic, kind of isolated society. You know, you were talking about technology earlier. So like the presence of social media, where you have this sort of masquerade of relationship, but it's not true. Like, you can have thousands of followers or friends, but that's not a real community to you. And that presence could make it harder to live a godly life.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, you know, for those of us that are discipling children or discipling young men in our churches, we have an opportunity to foster within them rightly ordered loves. So if you live yes. with somebody mm-hmm. in your home, or if you're closely related with somebody in your church, and that person has rightly ordered loves, loves the right things to the right degree in the right way, we hope that it sticks. We hope that it's appealing. And so as a parent, I'm thinking about that a lot and struggling and failing daily to help my kids love the right things in the right way. And it's a challenge, of course, that I need to take on as well, to love the right things in the right way.
So that's interesting, because the other thought that came to my mind, I didn't say it, but both of you connected to it directly. And I was going to ask you, Charlie, from your days in student life, if you experienced this next thing. But when I look back at my life, many times the friends I was the closest with had a major effect on me. And then when I began to grow, sometimes it involved changing friends. When you had lots of guys you were working with those years in student life, did you ever have examples where, like, this guy, you had to tell him, like, look, you got to stop hanging around these people? And then when they did they ever grow after that? And was it a difference?
Yes.
You want, okay, no more. That's fine. Hey, thank you for the yes. I can move on.
I will say there's a phenomenon that happens where you get a bunch of guys and girls in dorms, and, you know, birds of a feather.
That's right.
Sin together.
They do.
And so I've watched this play out numerous times, where you get a group of young men and there's usually a ringleader, but they do affect each other and they don't help each other be godly.
Yep.
And then what happens is one of those guys starts really getting interested in one of those girls.
Oh,
and,
no.
I always am a little skeptical of, they clean up their act to get the girl.
Ooh.
And I've watched that a bunch of times, and there's negatives to that. You can think about their motives, but just that by itself, how that helps them be godly, that they've now forsaken bad friendships with these men and found, you know, we don't know for sure, but a godly woman.
Sure. Yeah.
And they're like, I'm going to marry that person. And then they get married and you kind of look at them and you're like, well, I remember you when you were in the dorm and how you lived, but now you've created completely new associations in your life. And just that alone, how that helps that guy be godly to get married is interesting.
And I think we a little bit discount this part. And I think that's what this verse helped me with. There are factors outside of you that are almost operate at a default level. And if you would just put yourself in a better context, it would be better. So it's kind of, and I think this is maybe account like the, or the, some people might look at this and negatively say it. And so let's just talk about this, like the faith bubble. Okay. The Bible college bubble. People often talk about how bad Bible college is because it's just a greenhouse and there's no trials and blah, blah, blah. And you're around the Bible all the time. Well, also that happens at camp. Like sometimes you go to camp and you can't be on your electronics or whatever. And you make these great spiritual decisions that week. Why did that happen? I mean, Berg talks about this in his book. A camp decision isn't a bad decision. Sometimes it's a good decision because you removed all these bad influences. And so I think what this verse brought up is I think we need to pray for our leaders so the culture will be different and we can be godly and more easily. But the premise of it actually widens it out to the rest of my life. So I know there's, I mean, there's some people young, you know, about Charlie, you mentioned some of them, not by name, but I know someone who as a student wasn't really walking with the Lord very much. And then I've just noticed some big changes recently. And I talked to someone who was discipling them and they said, oh yeah, they made this significant decision that affected these people they hung around regularly. And it was very hard, but now they're not hanging around them. And I'm watching, I'm like, this person's not who they were. So here we go. So in this verse, we're talking about culture. We're talking about politics. We're talking about leadership. And Paul tells Timothy, pray for leaders so that you could live a quiet and godly life. So I think we could apply that in principle to, are there any areas in your life, listener, where the influences are not good? Can you pray that God would improve those influences? Now, part of that might be you removing those influences. I think that's a big one. That'd be one. But number two, if it's like a job and you work at your job and you can't really get a different job that quickly, you could be praying for your boss. You could be praying for your coworkers. You could just be being a light in front of them. And that oftentimes shuts down some stuff. The last thing I would say too, is that I think this verse teaches a lot about the reason that you pray for your leaders. It's not so that life will be easier and you can be happier and you don't have to worry as much. It's so that you can walk better with the Lord and serve him. So this verse sort of, if you think of the verse in James, it says, why doesn't God answer prayer sometimes? Because you ask it to consume it upon your lusts. You could pray for your leaders because you're tired of that and you just want this so you have a better 401k or blah, 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 blah. And I would say to be godly or an evidence of godliness is that you're praying for these things for the right reason. Okay, that's the first P. The second P is perspective. And so, Tim, do you want to read 2 Peter 3? 10 through 12 for us. And this one, listener, is an eternal perspective will lead to godliness. An eternal perspective will lead to godliness.
Is that 1 Peter? 1 Peter or 2 Peter?
Well, I'm going to click that link to confirm. I think it's 2 Peter. Yep, it's 2 Peter.
2 Peter, sorry.
What did I say?
Oh, I just misheard you. I don't know.
No, I might have said 1 Peter. I misspeak all the time.
Okay, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn? But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells.
Okay, so would someone like to take a shot at Peter is arguing to live a godly life? Do you just want to summarize what's his argument here? What's the what's he talking about here in these three verses? What is something that leads you to this godly life? Thoughts?
I mean, if we are contemplating all of the things in this world, this worldliness, then that's going to, it's going to mess up our focus. And so focusing on things that are eternal, focusing on the new heavens and the new earth, focusing on, boy, I'm kind of suffering right now. Okay. Well, that's okay, because what's really your focus is the eternal. You're looking for the city that's not made with hands. Then it can help us to grow in godliness. It seems like that's kind of the idea.
Yeah. What happens in the future to the present system in these verses? So we have our present earth, we have our present ways of things are going. What's going to happen according to these verses one day in the future, those?
The famous Greek paradigm, it's luoed.
Oh,
it's loosened.
it's
that's the one word that every Greek student should know. Luo. It's dissolved. It's loosened.
Yep. Listener, we're having some Greek fun here, because that verb that's in the middle of this passage is like, let it go. Tim, that was a cultural reference.
It was?
Oh man, come on. He was so close.
No, I knew it was.
Oh. I was like, come on, Tim, you can't do that to us. Yeah, so here, Peter is arguing, in the whole book, there's false teachers, and the false teachers they're sinful, and they live for sinful desires. And part of what Peter says is, hey, what is going to happen one day to all these things? All of this is going to be dissolved and go away. So if that's true, what kind of person should you be? It's interesting to me that he says, hey, essentially, everything's going to burn and go away. So what does that logically conclude to you? And he kind of assumes you're going to get it. That, well, if everything's going to burn, I shouldn't live my life for those things that are going to burn. If everything's going to dissolve, I shouldn't live my life for those things that are going to dissolve. I think that's pretty obvious, right? Like, pretty obvious. So then why does he have to say it to his people in this letter?
We just focus on the things that are right in front of us all the time, our appetites, mm-hmm. our comforts, and all of the things in this world, and none of that's going to matter. It's all just going to go up in smoke and ashes.
And I think it's very easy to think about those things. Like, I have to think about my hunger, because if I don't think about it enough, at some point I'll die.
Right.
I have to think about my thirst, because at some point if I don't think about it, I'll die. Mm-hmm. I have to think about my clothing, because if I don't think about it, at some point I'll get thrown in prison for public indecency. But these things are different, and you shouldn't think about them that much. So maybe a good application question for godliness then is, what in our current culture, like the world we live in, what encourages us to think about the present? What are some things in our current lives that encourage us to think about the present, not God's future? I think the easy one is entertainment. All entertainment is just living for right now, to be entertained in this moment. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, I'm bored. I need something to occupy me so I don't have to think about my life. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not that you can't engage in entertainments, but a lot of times those things are meant to take up your time and mm-hmm. distract you.
I think we can get caught up in our work
mm-hmm.
and we can easily become deceived that our work is, you know, for this life, and we ought to turn to Solomon and Ecclesiastes and realize that just like the sun, until the sun is gone,
mm-hmm.
it's going to rise every day and it's never going to stop. And just like that, we're going to rise every day and we're going to work and it's never going to stop. And our eye will never be satisfied with the work we do under the sun. And so, mm-hmm. but I think you can get caught up in like, this is my job. This is, I'm working to get these things like 401k retirement. You know, there's that carrot at the end of the mm-hmm. 60 years. It's, I'll retire and I'll have a big nest egg. And it's like, but then you die and all of it's given to a fool.
Yep. Yep.
And how is the wise any better?
And hey, that's the same thing. You die. Like, it's again, a perspective issue.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a little bit about this in relationship to what we spend time praying for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good and right to pray for people's temporal needs, health and things like that, or jobs or things like that. But I wonder if we had to pray about those things with a more eternal perspective. Mm-hmm. We obviously pray for healing, but we also pray that God's purposes, which are beyond our perspective, mm-hmm. will be accomplished, and, you know, and things like that.
Yep. So. And I think those things get more challenging, but also more apparent, the more serious the issue is. So, like, being real here, I prayed a lot for Robin to be healed, but I also knew that trials work things, and I had to like submit to like, okay, God, whatever you want in this. I think any of us who've gone through something hard, you want God to relieve you of it and take it away. But that perspective of like, why am I praying is like a big deal. It's really, really important. Something you said, Charlie, brought a thought to mind and now has gone away. Oh, work. Okay. So you were talking about like the investments in the future and things. The other thing I would say is sometimes it's even more excusable in one sense that like, well, I've got to work to support myself. Like if I don't work enough, I'm not going to have enough money. But how many Christians have we known who are working because they've got to provide for themselves, and then they're not involved in church? And could they work less? Is their job really that important? What if it's like a ministry job you work at and you're like, well, I've got to do this because blah, blah, blah. But if you're not involved in your local church and discipleship, where in the Bible is a ministry job? I mean, you know, like that could be a, like here on our campus, that could be an issue.
Sounds like they need the one sheet to rule them all.
They do. And
I'll just...
And actually, you need that someone outside of you, because that sheet functionally is like you outside of yourself telling your things. Yeah.
And I'll just say this is anecdotal, you know, not to indict anybody for what they do and the purposes they live, but it's really nice to have a job that's in its proper place, that it's in this, it's on the grid. There's 40 hours that goes to yep. Blue Cow, no more, no less.
No more, no less.
And that's important because that is how you support. That's mm-hmm. what frees you for so many other things that allows you to be a blessing in ministry to other people. But that can very easily, if I was to pivot my life out of a love of money or greed or a love of comfort and say, you know what, I'm going to, every night of my life, I'm only supposed to work 40 hours, but I'm going to, when I go home, I'm going to put 2 or 3 extra hours in to book a couple more moves. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's more, you know, that excel in this. In which I think there's a lot of positions like mine where it's all consuming and you'd be very successful mm-hmm. and comfortable. But then what are you sacrificing to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if I'm going to do that, I can't meet with these guys at the coffee mm-hmm. shop. I can't do that mm-hmm. Bible study. You can't read or write, you know, mm-hmm. cultivate the mind. Like you'd sacrifice so many things to that beast. And I think that is a struggle. And it's, I think there's a misconception that any job classified as ministry is exempt from that struggle.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think just the CEO of a Fortune 500 company has that problem. Mm-hmm. And it might be a little bit more acute because he's tempted by a much larger sum of money. But that same temptation could be had by an employee at our Bible college mm-hmm. to think that, you know, I could be all consumed by my job and sacrifice so many other things to mm-hmm. it. And that could easily be a passion rather than a correct affection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be a serious issue. So I think what I would say is here we see that you've got to have a proper perspective. And when you have that perspective, it changes how you live. And so I think what we see here is that it's changing what you value and how you value it. So in Peter's day, these people were living for worldly concerns because they valued them. But when you look at the end of history and you see what's going to be truly valuable, that working backwards shapes how you live each day. So listener, are there areas that you are living for the moment, like the right now? But if you weighed it against what's going to look like, what eternity is going to look like, would you go back and change how you're doing things? All right, go ahead.
So the 40-hour work week, you know, and particularly this is anecdotally, and Charlie said it was anecdotal, throughout the history of the world, most people don't get to work a 40-hour work week. Some of them had to work 50 hours, 60 hours, whatever else. So Charlie's interpreting and explaining that from his perspective, for him to work more, would be stemming from disformed or malformed affections.
And just to clarify on that, I would actually contend that I work probably like 70 hours a week, but Blue Cow only gets
40
of them.
And because you can do that in your life situation,
yeah.
Right. And so then you can devote yourself to things that are more eternal.
And I think that also can be a god to people. Like, okay, I'm only going to work the bare minimum.
Yep.
They can take advantage of their employer, which they shouldn't. That's mm-hmm. not virtuous.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've been, and this is, you know, rabbit trails are the lifeblood of podcasts. But the fact that, you know, what does Paul say in 1 Thessalonians? Laboring night yes. and day.
Yes.
And I was convicted a while back that I would get so burnt out by the other things that I'm doing that I was almost unwilling to get together with people in the evenings. It's like, no, I can't do that. That doesn't work. And it's like, well, I think you could make it work. And you reshuffle some things on that grid, and all of a sudden, guess what you can do? No, there's plenty of margin for that. And so, yeah, but just to...
And that's a really good just explanation and qualification, because some people will hear just the first part of that conversation, and then they'll use that as, oh, I'm working too much or whatever else. Well, what are you doing with your other time? Okay, so you may only work 40 hours, so then you can, what? You know, Charlie's only working 40 hours, so then he can invest in things that are eternal. And that's the goal.
Yes.
And if you're not investing in something that's eternal, well, what then are you using those hours for? Paul laboring night and day. You know, you should be laboring night and day for things that are eternal. Mm-hmm. And then work has to be part of that. So anyway, that's just what I wanted to caveat.
I know we're getting long here, but I can't wait to talk to Paul about this, where it's like, he's a tent maker. So he's literally, he's sewing canvas, he's cutting cords, you know, and is there in Paul's mind, like, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this. And then, but as soon as I hear this bell ring or whatever part of the day, the sun goes down, it's like, I'm not doing any tents and it's all people. You know, or like how strict of the lines did he draw? You know, and I think, I don't really know if he made distinctions like that.
Be filled with the Spirit, baby.
Yeah. And some days it's like, guess what? You're going to keep doing this. And then there's other days where, okay, like, and this happens to me. There'll be days where someone, I like to call them chatty Cathys. Someone will call in at like 3:57. I'm supposed to leave at 4. I'm planning to meet a guy at the coffee shop at 4. And it's just down the road. And it's like, okay, I need to leave right away. And someone will call in and they'll ask you every question you've ever thought about moving. And it's 4:30 before you leave. And you're like, oh man, I'm wasting my time. Well, no, you're not. You know, that person on the phone, you know, you could easily run into them. And there's then times on outreach, for my church, I'm knocking on somebody's door and it's like, I've seen this name before. And it was a customer of Blue Cow. And, you know, they've never yet noticed like my Blue Cow coat. Like they've never yet done that, but like, you're never wasting time with people. And so, interruptions are just as valuable to keep in your schedule. And I think that's something to think about too. But,
and even there, you're honoring the Lord by being a faithful employee. Yeah. You know, I'm sure your boss would, if you're like, oh, it's 4 or 5, I got to go, click. I'm sure you'd be like in his office the next day. So I would agree. I don't think we're arguing for that. But I like what you were pointing out, and you were pointing out is that if my work is so important that I don't do the actual work the Bible tells me to do, then something's out of whack. And at that point, this eternal look could help to like balance that back. All right. The third P. So we have the P of prayer. Praying for leaders leads to opportunities for godliness. So you should pray about your context of life, because that can actually affect your godliness. You also might need to consider who you spend most of your time with. Number 2, the P of perspective. Having an eternal perspective leads to godliness. And then number 3, a person. So this one's the most obvious one. The knowledge of God, and that's the person, leads to godliness. So in 2 Peter, at the very beginning, he says this. He says, his divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness. Now, that's a pretty... a famous section of the verse for the sufficiency of scripture teaching. But he goes on to say, through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence. So for this one, I just find it interesting that the way you have all the things that you need for life and godliness are through the knowledge of Christ, the knowledge of the Lord. Now, this seems pretty obvious. If I'm going to be godly, I need to know God. If I don't know God, I can't be godlike because I don't know him. So what I would say, a minimal statement here, godliness is supported by knowing God. So if you don't know him well, then you won't be able to be as godly as possible. But a maximal statement, you could say this, godliness is based on knowing God. And I'm definitely leaning in that direction. So then, in what ways do we better learn to know God? And I'll just make a couple of summary statements here at the end, and then I'll read a quote. But I would say, at minimum, being in God's word, because the revelation we have of God, him revealing himself to us, is in his word, and we're not going to find that elsewhere. Now, interestingly enough, this digital world book, I didn't plan this out, but today I was looking for quotes to read, and there's another really good quote in here. So I'm going to read this. So he's talking about digital media and the opportunities, and he's kind of weighing out, are these good opportunities or not? And so there's this guy he quotes, and so I'll just start reading a paragraph where he explains the thought. In many of the same ways, digital media are changing the way churches, synagogues, mosques, and temples do their business. Shane Hipps, the lead pastor of Trinity Mennonite Church in Phoenix, offers an apologia, a defense, for the use of technology in his book, Flickering Pixels, How Technology Shapes Your Faith. So he's going to quote a guy who's very pro using technology in church to argue for it. The book, says Hipps, quote, explores the hidden power of media and technology as a way to understand who we are, who we think God is, and how God's unchanging message has changed, is changing, and will change as a result of the mosaic of the flickering pixels. So he's trying to say that God's message doesn't change, but it changes in how it's deployed through all these different pixels and digital mediums. Now, I'm not sure I buy that. Okay. I'm gonna give that like the thumbs down. But then an interesting quote follows. And this is now the author of the book commenting on that. He says, borrowing Marshall McLuhan's famous aphorism, the medium is the message, Hipps then argues that Jesus is God's perfect medium, and the medium is the message.
Swing and a miss. You totally missed what McLuhan was saying.
I know. The funny thing is like, I don't think you can use that to support using all this digital media, but I do think he gets one thing really dead on right. If the medium is the message and Jesus is the message, then it makes sense why the incarnation was the best medium to get us to know God. So that part I thought was really good. Jesus incarnated is like, that sort of made me realize, oh yeah, what's the best way to know God? He could have sent revelations and all this, but actually becoming a human, like that's a really good medium. Now, he goes on to argue that this means we should use digital media and all that. I'm not going to argue for that. I don't agree. But I do think that in the same way I would just say that that has to affect how I think about God. I have to actually believe I'm getting to know a person. I have to actually believe I'm relating to a person. And that does make sense of a lot of New Testament stuff. So I think that's part of it. Go.
So McLuhan is, I think, a contemporary or a predecessor of Neil Postman. And Postman alludes to McLuhan in Amusing Ourselves to Death, like all through it. So that's why, you know, when I make that statement and Andy's bringing this up, we're reading that quote, knowing of this other stuff. And Postman's big argument was, no, the medium is words, not media.
Yeah, and the guy's saying, well, as long as I'm talking about Jesus, that's it. I'm right. like, no,
you totally
missed. The entire
missed.
Point is that how you talk about Jesus right. shapes it. And so that also makes you wonder, Jesus originally comes down incarnated, and then God chooses to have that inspired into a book, and that book is what we have. So then what do we actually need? I think we need time in God's word. And then what is the vehicle through which God carries out ministry of knowing him and edifying us today? It's the church. So if you want to be godly and you never are meditating on the Bible and you never go to church, you're not godly. Like, I don't care what you say, you aren't godly. You might feel spiritual, but not religious. You might feel like you've got a connection to the divine. None of those things are true. God has given his word and his son to us, and he's given us his body, which is the church. And so if you want to know the Lord, you have to be in those things. So, listener, thanks for being along with the study in godliness. I would ask you to consider some of these things as you walk away. So what are you praying for? And when it comes to your walk with the Lord and your godliness, are you praying about the context you're in? And are you willing to change that context if necessary, including getting new friends? Are you considering the future? Are you thinking about the day when Christ will come back and rule and reign and all things will be made right? Or are you consumed with the present and the worries and concerns and the rocky and stony soil of your life? And then lastly, are you in the Word and are you in a church? A church that actually one another's, a church that wants to disciple you and get into your life. If you are not, please consider that I think that's the most important way that you can take the next step of godliness in your life.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.